We discussed about Abdul Muttalib and his care for the Prophet. And now, Abu Talib, of course, he was the guardian of the Prophet after Abdul Muttalib. And we discussed that. There is a very beautiful description of Muhammad, the child, by Abu Talib, which is reported in different books. And I have just wrote a few lines of that description. This is reported by mainly by Ibn Shahrashud in his Tafsir. And he reports from Abu Talib about the Prophet. He says he always used to say Bismillah whenever he wanted to eat or drink. Remember, this is before Islam, of course, when he was 6-7 years old, or maybe 8-9 years old. After finishing his food, he used to say Alhamdulillah kathiran. And I was surprised, what type of expressions are these which are used by Muhammad? I never heard a lie from him, nor did he behave like the people of Jahiliyyah. He usually did not play with the children and always preferred to be alone. And this preference of Prophet to be alone all the time, especially before prophethood, was very conspicuous in him. Everyone noticed that he liked to be alone. And we will come to other instances when, for example, he always, as soon as he found a time or an opportunity, he would have liked to be alone with himself. Of course, after prophethood, he didn't find that chance anymore. And that's why, because he was always among the people after prophethood, he, whenever he was in a gathering or a session teaching afterwards, he used to say Astaghfirullah 70 times, because apparently he was a bit uncomfortable when he was among the people. But he had a mission, he had to discharge that mission anyhow. His loneliness was a gift for him, but of course he had to somehow compromise that with the mission that he had. Now, due to the sublime position that Abu Talib knew of Muhammad, he never trusted anyone about him. He always wanted to somehow watch Muhammad himself, care for him himself. And once he revealed to his brother Abbas, other Prophet's uncle, that I do not part from Muhammad day or night, if I do not trust anyone about him. And through these reports and all other reports, we know that Abu Talib perfectly knew what is Muhammad going to be, and he has a mission that has to fulfill. And especially, they were told by some sorcerers and others that you have to look after this child very much. He said, I even take him to bed myself. And however, when he needs to change his clothes, he asked me to turn my face. Something which was not usual at all with other children, with their grandfathers or uncles or whatever. And of course, there are other descriptions. Just I wanted to give a very brief description of how Muhammad was seen by Abu Talib when he was a child. Now, when the Prophet was 12 years old, Abu Talib took him to Sham on a business trip. And of course, all of you know, have heard about this very important trip of Muhammad, peace be on him. Of course, there were several reasons why Abu Talib took Muhammad with him, because it was unusual for a 12-year-old boy to go. First of all, he could not trust anyone about Muhammad, so he wanted Muhammad to be with him. And secondly, maybe he wanted to train Muhammad somehow, how the caravan goes, how they come, to give him some opportunity for future business. And in this trip, according to Ibn Ishaq, he met with Bahira in a monastery near Busra. Usually, when the caravans went to Sham, there was a business center called Busra. That was the destination. And usually they exchanged whatever they had there in Busra, and they came back. Now, close to Busra, about 12 kilometers to Busra, there was a monastery in which a very, very respectable monk, Christian monk, lived. And that monastery, it said that it was dedicated to the most pious monk among the Christian monks. And this Bahira was the one who was actually being situated there because of his great knowledge and the great respect that he had among Christian monks. Now, this report is a very, very famous one. It is reported by Ibn Hisham, Ibn Ishaq, Tabari, Saduq, in Kamaluddin as well. So both Shia and Sunnis have reported the hadith. And the hadith is that usually these caravans went very frequently, especially during the summer. There were several caravans of Quraysh going to Busra and coming back, and they never remembered that this Bahira ever talked to them or invited them, or even they never saw Bahira. Bahira was in his chamber in the monastery, and he didn't care about caravans coming and going. On this occasion, Bahira looked out and saw the caravan coming and a piece of cloth moving over the caravan. And he was amazed and he was alerted that there is something special. It is said that he was actually waiting for something all his life there. I mean, the duration in which he was in that monastery, he was waiting for it. And, well, this was a sign. So he went down himself, or he sent someone, inviting all the caravan or the group to go and have food with him. And he said, bring everyone. Freemen, slaves, children, bring everyone. However, as I said, Muhammad didn't like to be in the group of people. So this was an opportunity for him. He said, I will look after everything. I sit here and you go. I don't come in. So he sat there, the people went there, and Bahira watched carefully, looked at everyone. He had someone to visit, but he was not there. He asked, are you sure you haven't left anyone behind? They said, there's a child only looking after our thing. He said, I told you, bring everyone, please, I want you. And they were surprised. They said, why are you inviting us now? This is every year we are going, coming, you never paid any attention. He said, well, you are my guest, I have to do it sometimes anyhow, and this is the time now. Now, when Muhammad, peace be on him, went to the monastery, and as soon as Bahira set his eyes on him, he feels something. This is a special person. So he went to him, he looked at his hands, he looked between his eyes, he looked at his shoulders, and then he said, I want you to swear for me by Lat and Uzza that whatever I ask you is true. You answer me right soon. He said, the Prophet said, you have asked me to swear to things which are most hated in my eyes. I never do. It doesn't work. Okay, inshallah, so we send this to you. Said that I never swear by these things. And Bahira said, well, I have heard your people swear by these gods. He said, they are wrong. Said, okay, I ask you to swear by God that you tell me the truth. I said, okay. Then he asked him, what do you dream? How you wake up? What do you see when you move around, for example? About his experiences and all these things he asked. And at the end he found out that yes, this is the one that everyone was waiting for, were waiting for. So he said, who is the father of this boy? And Abu Talib went and said, I am his father. Oh, well, that was a setback, because Bahira had heard that his father is dead. And he said, you can't be his father. He said, okay, I am his uncle. I'm not his father, but he's under my guardianship. He said, yes. Where is his mother? He said, his mother has passed away. And he asked some other questions. And he said, I tell you one thing. This boy, you have to look after him very carefully, because he is going to be someone very special. And you don't take him to Bosra with yourself, especially don't let the Jews know about him and know about his whereabouts. And don't let them to communicate with him. And this was something which is recorded in almost all sources. And he said that Abu Talib just went back right from there, or sent Muhammad, peace be upon him, right from there. Which is improbable, not probable, because as I said, Abu Talib did not trust anyone on Muhammad. So apparently, even if he made the business, he made it very quickly and went back to Mecca. And having known all these things, it is very funny to say that Abu Talib, after the Prophet said that he received revelation, he did not believe in him. This is something which is a made-up thing in the history. Although we know that Abu Talib concealed his faith, all true, because if he had revealed his faith, he could not protect the Prophet, because his protection was not accepted. Because protection was a type of contract, a type of acceptable custom, that if you were respected yourself, then you could protect someone else, to bring them under your zimmah. If you were not respected yourself, if your blood was not respected, then you couldn't protect anyone. And therefore Abu Talib didn't want to somehow take that protection from the Prophet. Why people have come to this conclusion that Abu Talib was not a Muslim, did not believe, and they have forged different ahadith about cause of revelation of some of the verses, for example, that Prophet wanted to do istighfar for him, and Allah said, no, it's not suitable for mu'minin to do istighfar for mushrikeen, and all these things, these stories they have made. Why is it made? Would anyone know? Why? Why Abu Talib? It's very important for some people to say Abu Talib was a mushrik, not a mu'min. Although it's not a very important issue. Why it was the case? Anyone know? Well, because at the time of Banu Abbas, there was a rivalry between Al Ali and Al Abbas. And it was very much to the benefit of Banu Abbas to say that our father Abbas was a mu'min and your father Abu Talib was not a mu'min, he was a mushrik. And then many things which is said about Abbas, you know, Abbas did not believe until very late. He was captured in the Battle of Badr, and Prophet took ransom and freed him. Even after Battle of Badr, he did not believe until the very latest stages of the conquest of Mecca. So they had to make some sort of merit for Abbas, and of course they had to demerit Abu Talib, the father of Ali, saying that, okay, this Al Ali, the father, although was with the Prophet also, he did not believe in the Prophet. So this is why this story has come about, which is a very funny story about Abu Talib, who actually dedicated everything he had for the Prophet, peace be upon him. Now, we come to the young Muhammad now. He grew, of course, after all these predictions, information, news about his prophethood coming from different quarters and directions, Abu Talib looking after him very carefully. Well, but of course he needed to earn some living for himself, because Abu Talib was very, very poor. He could not even feed his own children. So Muhammad, right from the beginning, had to find some earnings. Now, of course, the family were all businessmen. However, Prophet didn't like that very much. He had a type of inheritance which had come to him through his parents, some sheep, goats, something like that, not very much, which was kept for him, and he used to shepherd them, to take them to graze, along with the with a few of other relatives, cattle, sheep, or something like that. And he loved this very much, because this took him outside the city, outside the environment of Mecca, which in many instances was not a very, very healthy type of environment. He loved to go to the wilderness, to be with the animals. And even later on, when he did not do this, he loved to go to mountains, to open plains, so that he could have that opportunity to ponder and think, deliberation. And this is what he usually did. This is what he loved, to be alone all the time. And, of course, due to his immense honesty, right at his very young age, when he was in his teens, he was called Muhammad al-Amin, Muhammad the Honest, or the Trusted. And this is what everyone, of course, accepted about him. And this is what Quran emphasizes very much, that you haven't heard any lie from this Prophet before. You know him, you know his father, you know his past, you know his youth. So why do you think he's now lying to you about whatever he's saying? Now, when he was 25, he had a marriage with Khadija. Now, of course, Khadija was a very respected lady in Mecca, for whose hand many nobilities of Mecca had asked before Muhammad. Of course, she had married before twice, and she was from Banu Asad, daughter of Khuwaylid. And first she was married to Atiq ibn Aid, and he passed away very soon, and she was still very young. And then she married to Abu Hala, the famous father of Hind ibn Abu Hala, Abu Hala, who was Hind ibn Abi Hala is someone from whom Imam Hussein and Imam Hassan report things from the Prophet, characteristics of the Prophet, and such issues. And some people say that Hind was a daughter, not a son. Or some people say that they had two children, one son and one daughter, both were called Hind. And that's why Khadija was called Umm Hind as well. Now, Abu Hala passed away very soon as well. So Khadija was again widowed, but she did not marry for several years. She was 40 with great fortune. She was very wealthy because of the wealth that she had from her father. And both her husbands were very rich. And after they passed away, they had left her lots of wealth. So she was very wealthy, very respectable, very noble, and you can expect that everyone in Mecca would have liked to marry such a lady. Now, but apparently she had decided not to marry at all after her first two husbands. Now, there were other qualities for her as well, because her wealth was not kept for herself. She was also called Umm Sa'aliq, mother of the poor, and also Ummul Aitam, mother of the orphan, because her house was a place where different people, poor people, orphans, went, ate food, and she was very, very generous. And it was that character, that generosity, which actually encouraged many men in Mecca to think that they have to marry such a woman. Noble, having lots of wealth, being so generous, so all good qualities were actually had come together in Khadija. And of course, someone like Muhammad never thought that she would like, or he would want to marry Khadija, or Khadija would want to marry him. Now, one incident actually made this marriage possible, and that is the fame that Prophet had acquired for himself in terms of honesty and trust. Khadija had a habit of herself for business. Usually when he hired anyone to do business for her, to take her property to Sham and come back, she used to say, the benefit we share. And this is why everyone wanted to somehow make more benefit, actually. It was not only a wage given. Not only a type of set salary to be given. And therefore, everyone thought that, okay, we make more profit. But making more profit, they could cheat very much in that. So she wanted someone to be trusted. And she had heard about Muhammad very much, a very trusted young man. So she asked, sent someone to him and said, would you like to do some business for me? And of course, Muhammad, after consulting his uncle, Abu Talib, and other uncles, everyone said, yes, this is good. Doing business for Khadija is very good. So he accepted, and he set out on a business journey when he was 25. Not on his own, but with a slave man of a slave of Khadija called Maysara. Now this Maysara always went with the property, with those people who did business. He himself couldn't do business. So they went together. Maysara on the way saw very, very strange things from the Prophet. First of all, the honesty was reconfirmed. Secondly, the attitude, the type of statements that Prophet made. And one very strange thing, again, one of these monks, called Nasturus, near Busra. Again, he saw something very strange in Muhammad, and he told Suventer that this man is a special. Who is this man traveling with you? He said, he's a man from Mecca. He said, this man is very special. And also, Maysara saw himself. That very strange thing happening when he was going with the caravan to, with Abu Talib to Bahira, the previous time, the same thing happened. A cloud was moving upon his head. And, of course, not everyone could notice that. But people who had insight about this, who were waiting for this sign, apparently it was a very significant sign about it, could notice it. And this Nasturus told Maysara that you have to be careful about this man. And, of course, coming back, Maysara described everything, explained everything for Khadija. And this rose some interest in Khadija about Muhammad. Because Khadija herself, she had decided not to marry, probably because she knew that she was waiting for someone who was going to become a prophet. There are some reports saying that she had some news about it as well. Also, you know, Khadija was not an ordinary woman. She was a very, very special woman. We have in this hadith that among the men, many people reached complete perfection. But among the women, only four reached that complete perfection. And those four, of course, were Khadija, and Maryam, and Asiya, wife of her own, and Fatima, daughter of Prophet, peace be on them all. No, so, if Khadija is lying with Maryam and with Asiya and with Fatima, so it's not the case that she only, when she heard about the revelation from the Prophet, she believed in him. It should have been more than that. Something coming from Khadija herself. And this is why, as soon as Khadija heard what Maysara had told her, immediately she sent someone to the Prophet and said that I'm interested to marry. And it was not very common for ladies sending someone to propose to men, but Khadija was very eager. And before that, of course, she went to her cousin Waraqat ibn Nawfal, the famous man that you have heard. There were some people at the time of Jahiliyyah who had deserted idol worshipping. One of them was this Waraqat ibn Nawfal, who had become a Christian. The other one was Ubaydullah ibn Jahsh, who was looking for something other than idolatry, and as soon as Prophet mentioned about his revelation, he believed in him, and he migrated with Umm Habiba, his wife, to Abyssinia, who was the daughter of Abu Sufyan, and of course he passed away there. And of course Umm Habiba, the daughter of Abu Sufyan, she had become a Muslim, she couldn't go back to her father and to her family, she didn't have anyone, and therefore the Prophet sent a message to Najashi to actually propose to Umm Habiba for him. And he married Umm Habiba while Umm Habiba was in Habasha, Abyssinia. Of course she was daughter of Abu Sufyan, but it's a different daughter, of course. Very different from Abu Sufyan himself. Now, there were other people as well, like for example Zayd ibn Amr ibn Nufayl, who was Umar ibn al-Khattab's uncle, who was actually searching for the truth. And he went out of Mecca. He looked everywhere. He asked from Christians, Jews, and of course he was not satisfied by what they said. And he said, I want to be under the religion of Ibrahim. And they told him, why you are wasting your time? Someone is going to come in Mecca soon. So go back to Mecca. And he came back to come to Mecca. But both Umar ibn al-Khattab and his father Khattab, they were very, very angry about what he had done. So they had someone to kill him before he reached Mecca. It was another one. Now this Waraqat ibn Nawfal will come to him again. Once more will come to Waraqat ibn Nawfal. But apparently Khadija trusted him very much. And before proposing to the Prophet, she went to Waraqat ibn Nawfal and said that these are the signs I have seen from this man, I want to marry him. What do you say? And he said, if what you say is true, this man is very special. So do not hesitate in what you have decided. And then of course she sent someone to the Prophet, to of course young Muhammad, and asked him, and of course Prophet consulted with his uncles, with Abu Talib and others, Hamza, and all of them said, this is the best wife that you can ever find in your life. She's a very noble woman, very generous and all these things. And Prophet, decided to marry her. The marriage ceremony was not a very splendid one, because Prophet and his family were not very rich. But of course, on the Khadija side, they were very rich people. I have brought here a khutbah from Abu Talib, because Abu Talib actually recited the khutbah of this marriage, which is again telling us that Abu Talib knew right from the beginning that who this man, his nephew, was. And it's very, very interesting to hear what Abu Talib actually said at that time, when 15 years before Ba'tha, of course, this is. He says, of course, I've not brought the whole khutbah, just a few sentences from it. Alhamdulillah alladhi ja'alana min dhurriyyat Ibrahim wa zara'i Ismail. We praise God that has made us from the descendants of Ibrahim and the progeny of Ismail. And then he goes on counting the fathers, very righteous ones. And then he says, thumma inna ibn akh, my nephew, hada Muhammad ibn Abdullah. This nephew of mine, Muhammad ibn Abdullah, لا يوازن برجل من قريش إلا رجح به. You would not weigh him against any other man in Quraysh unless he would have preference over them. ولا يقاس بأحد منهم إلا عظم عنه. And he is not compared with any other man in Quraysh unless you find him to be greater. وَإِنْ كَانَ فِي الْمَالِ مُقِلًّا. Although he's very poor. Well, in such a ceremony that you find a very, very poor man marrying a very, very rich woman, there should be some qualities in that very poor man. And Abu Talib says, although he's very poor, but you cannot compare him with any other man in Quraysh. وَإِنْ كَانَ مُقِلًّا فِي الْمَالِ فَإِنَّ الْمَالِ ذِلٌّ ذَائِلٌ وَعَارِيَةٌ مُسْتَعْجَلَةٌ. Because poverty, wealth is just like a shadow which is removed soon. And it's just like a borrowing, you borrow and you have to give back. However, وَلَهُ وَاللَّهِ خَطْءٌ عَظِيمٌ وَنَبَأٌ شَائِعٌ. And I swear by God that this man has a big mission. And his news is known everywhere. Now, his news is known everywhere means that everyone knows that this man has a big future. Although he's poor now, this man has a big future. وَلَهُ رَغْبَةٌ فِي خَدِيجَةٌ وَلَهَا فِيهَا رَغْبَةٌ. And she is interested in Khadija, and Khadija is interested in him. فَزَوَّجُوهُ. So, what are you waiting for? Let's have the marriage between the two. وَالصَّدَاقُ مَا سَأَلْتُمُوهُ. Apparently they had asked for some mahr, something which of course Prophet could not afford. So, he says, whatever you have asked for the mahr, it is in my property. Of course I can't pay all of it now, but maybe in future I will pay that mahr. Now, there are differences of report, what was the mahr of Khadija or whatever, not very important thing, anyhow. But why I brought the khutbah, just to show that in every statement of Abu Talib you find that this man has a great mission, a great future. And this was known by Abdul Muttalib as well. Now, this was a good relief for Muhammad, because he didn't need to do any business anymore. Of course, for us doing business is a pleasure. For Muhammad doing business was a torture. He didn't like to do business, of course. He had to earn his living, and apparently this was a big burden on him, to do business, to find money, to live. And marrying with Khadija, with that generosity, with those qualities, he could be relieved now. He could just dedicate his time to worship. And probably this is the meaning of the verse in Surah Duha, أَلَمْ يَجِدْكَ يَتِيمًا فَآوَى. He found you yatim and he gave you shelter. وَوَجَدْكَ آئِلًا فَآوَى. You were poor and Allah provided for you through Khadija, of course, that you did not need to bother anymore. You could completely dedicate yourself to me and come to worship me. Now, of course, after marrying with Khadija, Muhammad had 6 children from Khadija, as you know, 2 sons, 4 daughters. And the sons passed away, both of them, when they were very young, Qasim, and that's why Prophet is called Abul Qasim, and Abdullah. And the daughters, of course, they lived until after Ba'tha, and all of them believed in the Prophet, and they migrated to Medina, and they passed away one after the other, and the last one who passed away was Fatima, of course, after the Prophet. All other 3 passed away during the lifetime of the Prophet. And, well, I think that's all I wanted to say about Khadija and the Prophet. And now Prophet actually used to go not to pastor sheep or goats or something like that. He used to go to a place of contemplation, and Hira especially, in the mountain. And of course Khadija was more than happy to serve this man, because she knew that he is going to become a prophet. He needs this type of training that he had set for himself. During Ramadan he was going, other times he was going, so he had set for himself such a training. And of course Khadija was more than happy to serve, to help. And there are some other incidents during the life of the Prophet before Ba'tha. One of them, of course, it's mentioned that he took part in some of the battles of Jahiliyyah between tribes, which is not true, it's not authenticated, and I think we just discard it, because it's very, very improbable that Prophet would have taken part in any battle, tribal battle, because tribal battle is not for right or wrong, it's is something which is done for taking revenge or having some benefit or something like that. However, there was a pact, حلف الفضول, a prophet took part. And the pact was a sort of noble pact against oppression. You know, when people came from far away places to Mecca and they wanted to do business, they didn't have their tribes with them. So if anyone wanted to wrong them, since there was no police force, the police was inside the tribe. Actually, every tribe policed their own members. Now, if, for example, you shed the blood of someone who is outside the tribe, and that person doesn't have any tribe to protect him, no one would tell you anything. It's just like, for example, if you commit a crime against someone else, and you don't have anyone to go and complain or put a complaint with the police, no one would care about it. And in that situation, of course, it was very difficult for people coming away from their tribe, doing, for example, business in Mecca. Of course, people honored their contracts because of the qualities of manlihood, also because if they did not honor it, then people wouldn't have come to do business in Mecca. However, once someone came from far away, he sold something to one of the people, one of the nobility of Mecca, and the man said, I'm not going to give you the money now. And he said, you have to, we made the contract. He said, no, I'm not going to give it, or I'm not going to give it to you, all of it. And this man went to everyone. Everyone said, it's not our business. You go and sort it with him. So, three people who named were thousands, they came together and they said, this man is wrong and we have to protect him. And they made a pact which was called حلف الفضول, the pact of the three thousands. And they said, anyone who wants to join us should join us. We would act as a police force, as a tribe for anyone who has no tribe here, as a protection for anyone who has no shelter here. And they actually were very strong people. One of those people who joined this pact was a prophet. Well, as you would have expected, because of his qualities, he did join this pact. It was a very noble pact to serve the poor, to serve the oppressed, and helping them. This is one incident. The other incident was reconstruction of Kaaba. This was 5 years before Ba'tha. The Kaaba, one wall of the Kaaba was destroyed due to a flood, which had happened a few years ago. What people didn't like to destroy Kaaba and rebuild it, they were afraid to do that. Of course, Kaaba was not like what you see now. It didn't have ceilings, it didn't have a roof, it was just four walls. And the walls were not taller, higher than the height of an ordinary person. Like, for example, this house. So, if you wanted, you could just take your head up and look inside Kaaba. What's inside Kaaba? And of course, there were treasures inside Kaaba. And those treasures were kept in a type of cellar, which was inside the Kaaba. And it was very easy for someone to come and plunder that treasure. And actually, it did happen. Someone had come and had plundered all those treasures, gold, which was inside the Kaaba. So they meant to put a roof for Kaaba for several years. But to put a roof for Kaaba, it meant that they had to rebuild the whole structure. The structure which was there could not actually tolerate the heaviness of the roof. So they were thinking of destroying that for several years, and eventually they said, well, it can't go like that. The flood has come, one wall is just on the verge of coming down, and the other three walls cannot take the roof on themselves. So they said, what should we do? They said, we have to destroy this and build another one. But they said, okay, who would start destroying the walls of Kaaba? And everyone was afraid. They said, no, if you do this, we are going to be punished. You can't do that. Of course, this was done before as well, but now several hundred years or many, many years, generations have passed. Waleed ibn Mughayra, I have talked about him before. You know that figure in Mecca, of course, one of the most noble people in Mecca. Of course, he was very noble, but after Islam came, he became ignoble, in the sense that Quran mentions that he was someone who did not care about إِنَّهُ فَكَّرَ وَقَدَّرَ فَغُسِلَ كَيْفَ قَدَّرَ. May God kill him. How did he judge and measure? It was about him. Now, he went and said, okay, I start destroying one of the walls, and you destroy the other walls. And they said, okay, you start and we will follow you. He started, he destroyed one wall, and they said, okay, we wait tonight. If you are not punished, if you are not killed, then we start tomorrow. And, well, nothing happened overnight, and they started to destroy the whole construction, and they wanted to go down to the foundation laid by Ibrahim. And they did. They actually digged the under the walls, and they went down, and they reached the foundation laid by Ibrahim. And it is recorded, I don't know, these are isolated reports, whether right or wrong. They said as soon as they started to put their faith and their digging means. Yeah, as soon as they wanted to dig there, the whole Masjid al-Haram started to shake. So they stopped there, and they rebuilt the walls of Kaaba to about the height of 8 meters. So it was probably four times the height it was before at that time. And they put a roof on it with wooden roof. And of course, there's a long story about where did they bring these wood and all these things. And interesting that how these details are mentioned in the history of Kaaba, because Kaaba was very, very important. And now the problem was, okay, who should place Hajar al-Aswad on the corner? The corner, it always was in that corner. Who should place Hajar al-Aswad? Of course, at that time when the wall of Kaaba was this high, Hajar al-Aswad was here, almost at the top. Now they wanted to put it the same place, but of course it would have become far lower than the roof of Kaaba. Now, they started to quarrel. Okay, which side should put this on to place this Hajar? And every tribe said it is us who should do it, and they started actually to prepare for a war against each other. And at the end they said, well, we shouldn't quarrel, we shouldn't fight for this, we shouldn't shed blood here in Mecca for placing Hajar al-Aswad. And then they agreed to an arbiter. And they said, okay, who should be the arbiter? From us, from you. And at the end, one of them said, okay, the first person who comes from this Babu Shayla, we take him as an arbiter. So we don't say from which tribe, from which group, the first person which comes in. And the first person who came in was Prophet Muhammad. Of course, everyone was happy. This is Muhammad al-Amin. Of course, he was not a prophet at that time. Otherwise, everyone would have been scared. So this is Muhammad al-Amin. We all accept his judgment. And he came and they said, they explained the problem for him. And he said, okay, bring me a cloak or a blanket or something. And he put Hajar al-Aswad in the middle. And he said, okay, every tribe takes one side of this blanket. And they took it to that wall and Prophet placed it there with his own hands. And amazingly, no one said, you are from Banu Hashim, why you do this? Because, well, everyone was tired of quarreling, probably. And this was something which, of course, gave more honor to the Prophet, because the news spread that Hajar al-Aswad was placed by Muhammad in its place. And, of course, that Kaaba was there for several years until the 63rd year of Hijra, when, of course, Kaaba again was destroyed by catapults of Yazid against Ibn Zubayr. And then, of course, they rebuilt it again later on. Now, when Prophet was 37, 3 years before that, he started to have very strange experiences, more than what he had before. Of course, if you remember, we mentioned that right from his childhood, as soon as he was weaned, there was an angel guiding him, telling him what to do, what not to do, inspiring it in his heart, actually. And of course, Prophet followed. However, now he started to experience differently. His dreams became a bit different. The things that he heard and he saw became a bit different. He didn't, of course, see any angel, but he heard them very much. Especially in dreams, angels came to him and talked to him. And even once during the night, in a dream, he heard that an angel told him, "Assalamu alayka ya Rasulallah." And he was very, very amazed. What is the meaning of Rasulullah? Why they are calling you Rasulullah? Of course, if everyone knew about the future of the Prophet, he himself knew as well. But of course, knowing something is different from experiencing, and he was now experiencing that. Also, it is reported that when he was walking alone, going to the mountains or going to the wilderness, he was hearing the stones, the trees, everything saying, "Ya Muhammad, Ya Rasulullah," and greeting him. Of course, some historians say that it was that angel who was with the Prophet greeting him, and he saw that it's the trees and the stones and these things telling him, "Assalamu alaykum Ya Rasulullah." But anyhow, this is what he heard. And it was a very strange feeling for him. Strange thing, it was actually preparing him for that final stage of receiving a true revelation from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Also, his dreams became as such that, for example, he saw things in dreams and without any explanation, interpretation, needing any interpretation, exactly the same thing that he had seen would have happened. And this was another strange experience for him. Not like our dreams that we say, okay, we have seen this and this might happen in this way. Something like that would happen and we say, okay, this is the interpretation of that dream or something like that. No, exactly what he had seen in the dream would have been taken place in reality. And these, of course, continued, especially when he was in Hara, when he was alone, when he retreated in Ramadan especially, he used to see lots of these things. Now, it is said that on 27th of Rajab, or the night of 27th of Rajab, he was sleeping in the cave and Ali was with him. And he said also Ja'far was there as well, Ja'far ibn Abi Talib. They had brought him some food or something. And he saw in the dream that two angels came and they sat by his, one of them by his head, the other by his hoof, and they said, "Are we bringing message to this man?" And it was Mikael and Jibreel, and Mikael said, "Are we bringing message to this man?" And Jibreel said, "Yes." And Prophet woke up, very much amazed. And then when he woke up, he saw the two angels sitting there. And this, of course, made him very, very frightened that the same thing that he had seen in the dream, they were there. And then they told him, Jibreel of course told him, it is said Jibreel gave him a type of parchment on which it was written, "Iqra bismi rabbika alladhi khalaq," and he told him, "Read." And Prophet said, "I cannot read," and then again he said, "Read." But this hadith is somehow flawed. We cannot believe in this hadith for several reasons. Because in the hadith it said that the angels asked, "Is this the man or the other two? We have to whom should we bring the message?" And secondly, we don't have any account of the Prophet being able to read after Prophet. He was not able to read before Prophethood and he was not able to read right after Prophethood. And therefore, we cannot say that they brought a parchment on which it was written, "Iqra bismi rabbika alladhi khalaq." No. They actually revealed it to his heart. Now, according to that account of Bukhari, which says that Jibreel told the Prophet, "Read," and he said, "What should I read? I cannot read." And he pressed him, Jibreel pressed him, And again Prophet said, and again said, told him, read, and he said, what should I read? If we see this hadith to be authentic, what we can say is that actually the revelation was coming to the heart of the Prophet, but Prophet could not receive it. And Jibreel actually pressed Prophet's soul in a way to be adjusted to that message. And again told him, read. Well, Iqra both means read and recite. So Jibreel wanted the Prophet to recite, not to read from him, to recite. And of course, Jibreel knew what he was giving to the heart of the Prophet, but Prophet was not receiving it. And that three times that Jibreel pressed the Prophet means that Prophet actually became prepared to receive that message, to recite that message. And it was given to him. Now, the accounts of this first revelation to the Prophet differ very much. I mean, if you go to Ibn Hisham, he has written it in one way. If you go to Bukhari, he has written it in another way. If you go to Shi'i sources, they have written it in another way. And therefore, we cannot rely on the details of this. What we can rely on, firstly, is the Quran. And secondly, by the qualities that we know of the Prophet, we can judge which one of these traditions should be more reliable or acceptable than others. Now, first of all, Quran tells us that in Surah Al-Najm, وَالنَّجْمِ إِذَا هَوَى مَا ذَلَّ صَاحِبُكُمْ وَمَا غَوَى وَمَا يَنْطِقُ عَنِ الْهَوَى إِنْ هُوَ إِلَّا وَحْيٌ يُوحَى عَلَّمَهُ شَدِيدُ الْغُوَى. The powerful angel has taught him. عَلَّمَهُ شَدِيدُ الْغُوَى. ذُو مِرَّةٍ. The one with great intelligence. And we know that Jibreel is the most intelligent angel, or even the most intelligent being in the world, if there was not those intelligent human beings. So, ذُو مِرَّةٍ فَاسْتَوَى وَهُوَ بِالْأُفُقِ الْأَعْلَى ثُمَّ دَنَى فَتَدَلَّى فَكَانَ قَابَ قَوْسَيْنَ أَوْ أَدْنَى فَأَوْحَى إِلَىٰ عَبْدِهِ مَا أَوْحَى. Jibreel stood in the horizon in his original form, and then came next, and they revealed to the Prophet what he revealed. And at that moment, Prophet was very close to God or very close to Jibreel. Well, we don't know what this ayah exactly means. And then, the very important crucial verse says, مَا كَذَبَ الْقُعَدُ مَرَى. The heart did not deny what he saw. It's very important, because then you can judge many other traditions with this. مَا كَذَبَ الْقُعَدُ مَرَى. أَفَتُمَارُونَهُ عَلَىٰ مَا يَرَىٰ. Are you arguing with him about something that he saw, and he did not deny or hesitate about it? Because, for example, when two people argue about their views, if it's only views, that's okay. They argue about it. But if someone is completely certain about it, for example, I am a person who can see, I see it's nice, and a blind man comes and argues with me about whether it's nice or dead, and he brings arguments for it. Of course, it's not a valid argument, because I can see, he cannot see. And here, it says in the verse that he sees whatever he is saying. So are you arguing with him about it? That no, you are wrong, you don't understand, you may be mistaken or something like that. So the verse tells us that مَا كَذَبَ الْفُعَادُ مَرَعَ. The heart did not deny what is. Now, some of these traditions coming about the first revelation tells us that Prophet did not believe what he saw, or he did not know what he was seeing. He thought that he was possessed by a jinn or by a shaitan. And the most hateful thing at that time was that if a person became possessed by a jinn. And this is what had come in the tradition of Tabari, of Bukhari, that Prophet came back to Khadija and told her that I am afraid, or I fear, that I may have been possessed by a jinn. And he said, this man has become vicious. And the things which he said to Khadija, which are really unacceptable from the Prophet saying these things. And Khadija told him that no, you will never be like that, you will be never possessed by a jinn, because you are a good man, you are a righteous man, you do good to your family, to everyone. God wouldn't allow this to happen for you. Now, Khadija is, of course, Khadija's position was very hard, but why Khadija would understand this and the Prophet wouldn't understand it. And then the account has it that Khadija goes to Waraqah ibn Nawfal again, the famous cousin, the knowledgeable cousin, and explains for him what has happened to her husband. And Waraqah says that what you have explained, well, of course, Waraqah asks the Prophet to go to him, the Prophet goes to him, and Prophet explains to him, as if Prophet doesn't know what has happened. And Waraqah tells him that, no, I swear by God, this is the great Nomos, the great Spirit of God, which has come to you. This is the same Spirit which came to Moses, the same Spirit which came to Jesus, and that comes to you. So you shouldn't be afraid or concerned about it. You shouldn't be worried about it. And this somehow reassured the Prophet that he was a prophet. Ah, can we accept this? It's very difficult to accept. I mean, prophets, someone with all those experiences, although Waraqah was a knowledgeable man reading books, but he never had the experience of a prophet. Especially in the last 3 years of his life before Bi'tha, he should have known what is an angel, what is a jinn, what is evil, what is right, and it is very, very difficult, very unacceptable to think that Prophet thought that he was being possessed by an evil spirit or evil type of creature. Now, we discard the tradition. Any tradition coming in that way. Of course, Ibn Hisham mentions similar thing, but he doesn't mention anything about evil spirits or jinns or Prophet being afraid that he was possessed or something like that, which is of course more acceptable than the report coming from Bukhari. Now, in Shi'i tradition, we have that composure of the Prophet at the time when he received revelation. Mention of that composure, and also Prophet completely knew what was happening, who had come to him. He saw Jibreel, as Quran said, he saw Jibreel in its original form, and of course he saw him once again in that form, because usually Jibreel came to the Prophet in form of human being. I think we have discussed this before. There were two types of revelation. One, when the Prophet's soul should have gone up to the world of angels to receive revelation from Jibreel. Of course, when we say the soul goes, not leaving the body, it's just the type of level of the soul going there. And this was very, very difficult for the Prophet. Very difficult. Because every time if he wanted to do this, it would have exerted great pressure on him, on his body. The other type of revelation was when the angel came to the human world and assumed a human form. Like the way the angel came to Maryam. Of course, Maryam was not at that level to see the angel in his original form at all. And she couldn't go to that realm. But for Prophet, it was possible to go to that realm. But it was very difficult. So, the angel usually came to the human realm and the Prophet talked to him. Not other people wouldn't have seen him, but Prophet could see him, could talk to him, he could reveal things to him. And there was another revelation, type of revelation, which was the most difficult, as Prophet mentioned, and that was a revelation without mediation of Jibreel. This was something which almost killed the Prophet whenever it came. And in some occasions that you have heard that when revelation came to the Prophet, he sweated, he fainted. That was the revelation without the mediation of the angel. So these mediations are very important. And it somehow make things smoother for special mediation of angels between the realm of God and realm of human being, realm of matter. This mediation is very, very important. So it's, yes.
So you're saying the first time you talk about that, the direct revelation from God to the prophet.
To prophet's heart, yes. Yes, it was like that. And prophet said that whenever this type of revelation was coming, I heard a sort of a sound like bell sound. Sound of bell, like the bells of the church, okay, and chiming of the bell, and afterwards it was very difficult. Something very, very heavy came upon me. It's in tradition when prophet was asked how revelation comes to you.
The revelation was.
No, we don't know. As far as I know, we cannot actually identify which verses came by which type of revelation. And revelations to the prophet, for example, Musa alayhi salam received revelation without mediation from angel. But Allah created a sound for him. And that's why Quran says, وَكَلَّمَ اللَّهُ مُوسَى تَكْلِمًا. Allah spoke to him. Musa, without mediation of the angel, it was direct creation of the sound for Musa, and Musa received revelation in that way. I don't know whether our prophet ever received such a revelation at all or not. I don't remember anywhere mentioning such a revelation coming to our prophet, creation of sound directly without, because usually angels speak like human beings to the prophet, but creation of sound directly speaking to the prophet. This is what Quran mentions as one of the specific types of revelation coming to Musa only. تَلْكَ الرُّسُلُ فَضَّلْنَا بَعْضَهُمْ عَلَىٰ بَعْضٍ مِّنْهُمْ مَنْ كَلَّمَ اللَّهِ. To some of them, Allah spoke that. وَرَفَعَ بَعْضَهُمْ فَوْقَ بَعْضٍ دَرَجَاتٍ. And then it says, وَكَلَّمَ اللَّهُ مُوسَىٰ تَكْلِيمًا. And Allah spoke. In his tone. Not really, but we have that when Prophet went to Mi'raj, he actually heard that type of sound. And the sound was the sound of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And actually Prophet was amazed. He said, is Ali here? And Allah said, no, he is not here. But I knew that you liked this sound very much. I created the sound like his sound, so that I speak with his sound to you. But with other prophets, I don't know. Or anything when prophet was receiving other revelations. Anyhow, the Quran says that prophet saw Jibreel in his original form on that occasion. And then it says, وَلَقَدْ رَآهُ نَزْلَةً أُخْرَى. Once more he saw him in that type of construction, in his original construction. عِنْدَ سَدْرَةِ الْمُنْتَهَى. At سَدْرَةِ الْمُنْتَهَى, when actually Prophet was leaving Jibreel in his mirage going higher. And Jibreel told him that, I cannot come higher than this. Why he saw Jibreel in that form there? Because that was the realm of Jibreel, wasn't it? So, if Prophet had gone that high, it was his realm, so he would see Jibreel in that form. عِنْدَ سِدْرَةِ الْمُنْتَهَى عِنْدَهَا جَنَّةُ الْمَأْوَى إِذْ يَخْشَى السِّدْرَةَ مَا يَخْشَى. Again it said, مَا زَاغَ الْبَصَرُ وَمَا زَاغَ لَقَدْ رَأَى مِنْ آيَاتِ رَبِّهِ الْكُبْرَى. The eyes did not make a mistake, and they did not went out of control. It was completely in his control. It was composure, it was tranquility that Prophet had. So we cannot accept those things. As I said in other reports is that Prophet completely knew what was happening. And in Nahjul Balagha we have that report of Imam Ali alayhi salam saying that I was there with the Prophet, and in some other reports we have that he was there. And Prophet was not afraid, Prophet was not hesitant, and Ali says that وَلَقَدْ سَمِعْتُ رَنَّةً حِينَ نَزَلَ اللَّهِ. When the revelation came down, I heard a scream. Then I said to the Prophet, فَقُلْتَ يَا رَسُولَ اللَّهِ مَا هَذِهَا الرَّنَّةُ. What is this scream? فَقَالَ هَذِهِ رَنَّةُ الشَّيْطَانِ قَدْ أَيْسَ مِنْ عِبَادَتِهِ. This is the scream of Shaitan. He has now become disappointed that everyone would worship him. So, the accounts are very different from each other. And as I said, from the verses of the Quran, from the qualities that we know about the Prophet, from other reports that talk about the type of character, the type of attitude and constitution that prophets have, we can judge which report we have to discard, which report we have to accept. Is there any question? Shaitan revealing something to the Prophet. Now this takes us to these satanic verses of which we'll talk later on. And no, we cannot accept that because it's against the verses of the Quran. As I mentioned, the last verse of Surah Al-Jinn, عالم الغيب ولا يظهر على غيبه أحدا. He wouldn't make anyone. He is of course عالم الغيب. He knows the unseen, and he wouldn't give that knowledge to anyone. إلا من ارتضى من رسول, except those with whom he is pleased as messengers. فإنه يسلك من بين يديه ومن خلفه رصدا. Then of course there are gods. Before he receives the revelation, after he receives the revelation, they never allow shayateen to come close to him, close to the Prophet, close to the revelation. Because then this would completely falsify the whole idea of Prophet. And then we have another verse, وَمَا تَنَزَّلَتْ بِهِ الشَّيَاطِينَ وَمَا يَنْبَغِي لَهُمْ وَمَا يَسْتَثِينَ. Shayateen never can bring down such things to the Prophet. They have no control over the heart of the Prophet. This is very important. And Shaitan says himself, وَعِزَّتِكَ فَبِعِزَّتِكَ لَأُقْوِيَنَّهُمْ أَجْوَيْنِ إِلَّا عِبَادَكَ مِنْهُمُ الْمُخْلَصِينَ. No, I know what ayah you are saying. This is Surah Hajj. That وَمَا أَرْسَلْنَا مِنْ قَبْلِكَ مِنْ نَبِيٍّ وَلَا رَسُولٍ إِلَّا إِذَا تَمَنَّا أَلْقَ الشَّيْطَانُ فِي أُمْنِيَّتِهِ. We did not send any prophet or any messenger. That is general. It means not even one prophet is safe of this. That we did not send before you any messenger or any prophet unless when they wanted to do something. When they إِلَّا إِذَا تَمَنَّا, when they wish to do something, أَلْقَ الشَّيْطَانُ فِي أُمْنِيَّتِهِ. Shaitan did induce, did throw something in their wish. فَيَنْسَخَ اللَّهُ مَا يُلْقَ الشَّيْطَانُ. Then Allah would cancel that القاء of شيطان, that inducement of شيطان. ثم يختم الله آياته. Then Allah will reinforce his ayat. Now, those people, of course, under this verse, Tabari and some others have reported that the cause of revelation of this verse was that when Prophet was reciting the verses of Surah Al-Najm, أَفَرَأَيْتُمُ اللَّاتَ وَالْعُزَّى وَمَنَاةَ الثَّالِثَةَ الْأُخْرَى, Shaitan interfered and actually revealed some verses to the heart of the Prophet without Prophet knowing it. And he said, تَلْكَ الْغَرَانِيقُ الْأُولَى مِنْهُنَّ الشَّفَاعَةُ يُرْتَجَ. And this is what, of course, Salman Rushdie has taken and written that book about satanic verses. Because this is something which is in our books. Of course, in Sunni books, no Shi'i reporter or theologian has ever accepted this. Now, the point is that this refers to a very later stage in Revelation, very, very later stage in Revelation, when the Prophet was arguing with Mushrikun, probably 5th, 6th year of Bi'tha, and then Shaitan revealed something to his heart without him knowing, and then Allah cleared it. But do you say that this happened? Do you say that this happened in 6 years as well? No. Do you think that? Do you think that this would have happened? No. Do you think this would have happened in the 6 year of death as well? That Shaitan could reveal something to Prophet Muhammad without him knowing it? Because you are referring to a verse which has been revealed almost towards the end of the era, several years after this verse. I mean, one of the reasons that this verse cannot be the cause of revelation of Surah An-Nas.
Okay.
So you
could be caught, you know, almost the end of his pocket that happened in his year ago. You could have thought at the beginning what is happening.
So you are accepting this kind of verse?
I'm not accepting, you could argue.
Okay.
It doesn't mean he's got a very inconvenient.
This is conjecture at the end of the day, but it might be true.
Yeah.
It's
no.
It's not conjecture, it's
pointless. It's just a conjecture, thinking that it might have happened. But you see, the world of prophets are very different from our world. And the things that they see, they feel, are very different. They never need reassurance in these issues. They might need reassurance in terms of, for example, support, material support, in army, in troops, that's right. But reassurance of the heart in their relation with God, no, who can reassure them? I mean, who is Waraqat ibn Nawfal to reassure the Prophet? It's impossible. How Khadija could reassure the Prophet?
She was a great lady.
No, she was a great lady, but not greater than the Prophet. I mean, we can't bring this into this type of emotional world of husband and wife. But of course, the account of Prophet is completely away from this. We shouldn't bring that into this world of family life, compassion, support, these things. This is very, very different from what Prophet experienced. I mean, we have two accounts. One account which is conforming with the Quran, the other account which contradicts many verses of the Quran. So why should we accept an account which contradicts the Quran and discard an account which is conforming with the Quran? We take this one and discard that one. We have to take one of them anyhow. And why should we take that one? Because it has come in Ibn Hisham or in Bukhari. Why should we take it? It's against the Quran. It hasn't come in the Quran. Anything else?
So yes. When we talk about what he or her is, what is that the way it is?
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is ilham inspiration, because what is meant by how Allah.
No, it's all revelation, different types of revelation. It's different from the ilham and inspiration that we receive, for example, because all of us might receive some inspiration. No, it's all revelation, but once it comes direct to the heart of the Prophet from Allah, the other time it comes with mediation of an angel. Yes. Apparently not. He never did. He never did write anything.
Is that because of an imperfection, or is that?
Oh, it's not imperfection. I mean, for example, Prophet didn't live 100 years. He lived 33 years. Is it perfection or imperfection? You cannot say that. It was the reason. Prophet never ever could recite poetry. Never could compose poetry, never could memorize poetry. And whenever he wanted to read even one line of poetry, he made mistakes. Or he purposely didn't. Because Allah says, وَمَا عَلَّمْنَاهُ الشَّيْءُ. We have not taught him shirk. Why? Poetry is not a bad thing, of course. Poetry is a merit. But why Allah has not taught the Prophet poetry? Because of his purpose. Now, the purpose was that this is not a man of literature or poetry or something like that. The Quran comes from another source. And why Prophet couldn't read and write? Because again, Allah wanted to say that this is not a man who have ever read anything or written anything. I mean, people become experienced in reading and writing through time. After you write several books, then you make a masterpiece. You can write a masterpiece. But someone who never have read books, never have written any book, then of course coming with this Quran is a great book. And Quran explicitly mentions that. وَمَا كُنْتَ تَتْلُو مِنْ قَبْلِهِ مِنْ كِتَابٍ. Before this you were not reading any book. وَلَا تَخُطُّهُ بِيَمِينِكَ. And you were not writing anything with your hand. إِذَنْ لَرْتَابَ الْمُبْتِلُونَ. Had you been like that, then those mischievous people would have hesitated, would have broke doubts. This is a man, he is very clever, he has written this. And therefore, when there is a purpose, of course, and these things are not kind of imperfection, of course. And writing and reading is a skill, not perfection or something like that. It's not perfection of the soul, at least. It's a skill that we learn.
If you look at the behavior of the Prophet, as I said 3 years before, you look at the specific circumstances of revelation and physical aspects through which the Prophet went through. It was interpreted at the time, and perhaps even more so in modern times, as a kind of illness. And you have modern theories that talk about people who have an illness who can actually see in different realms, whether it's schizophrenia or epilepsy or mental illness. So how do we deal with that?
Well, this is exactly what the mushrikun said to the Prophet.
Yes.
That he is either a shayr, a poet, or a kahin. Now, kahin were that eccentric type of people, kahana, who had that type of visions which other people didn't have. It was on the boundaries of madness, something like that. And then the utter madness. They said either Majnoon or a Kahin or a Shair. The same thing they said. And exactly these things were happening at that time. That people had visions and extraordinary things, whether they were possessed by jinn or whether they had a schizophrenia that we know now, or all these things. However, how we can actually discern between them is by the statements that these people make. And of course, the Quran is a statement confirming all previous revelations. It makes complete sense. It is not something that people like sorcerers or poets or these people can ever make. And of course, people with schizophrenia or other type of madness or other type of psychological disabilities cannot bring these type of course back. Okay? Yes. You always hear it from whom?
From all the history that we have learned.
Yes, I have heard there are some very fervent supporters of the idea that Prophet had only one daughter, and that was Fatima. And I don't know where they have brought the idea from, because in all historical accounts it is mentioned that Prophet had 6 children from Khadija. Now, I don't know why we should insist on that. I mean, it doesn't bring any merit for Fatima, things like that. It doesn't agree with historical accounts, and I don't know why some people really insist on this. I haven't read writings of those people who insist on that. I haven't heard them, why they say this. Maybe, I mean, if you have heard or read something about it, why do they say that Prophet had only one daughter?
No, Uthman.
Ah, I see. Yeah, that's true. Because of Uthman. Well, even in that case, we cannot really discard just all those historical accounts. Just because, so why Prophet was called Abul Qasim, for example? Do they deny that he had sons from Khadija as well or not?
No.
Not other daughters?
Only daughters,
yeah. Ah, it's very difficult because about Zainab, who was married to Abul Aas ibn Rabi, a Mushrik, because she married before Ba'tha, actually Zainab. We have many instances of history which mention different types of events which happened about Abul Aas, about Zainab, for example, when Abul Aas, we have in history, when Abul Aas was captured in Badr and they wanted to take ransom, Zainab sent the ransom, the daughter of the Prophet, sent the ransom to Medina, and she included a necklace which belonged to Khadija in that ransom, and that when the Prophet saw that, he cried, he couldn't stop himself. He remembered Khadija. And then he asked the Muslimun, would you agree that we free Abul Aas without this ransom and we send all this to Zainab? And of course he freed Abul Aas on the condition that he would divorce Zainab and let Zainab to come to Medina. And then there are many instances in the history talking about how Zainab made the migration, what happened to her, when Abul Aas on another occasion came to Medina, what happened. I mean, you cannot reject all these. It's not only just an account saying that these were the daughters of the Prophet. There are different events which have happened in the history which brings up the issue again and again and again. It's very, very difficult to discover. Ruqayya and Umm Kulthum. And of course Zainab and Fatima. Now, we might discuss this when we come to marriage of the daughters of the Prophet, and we will explore, I mean, the issue of the marriage with Uthman, and it was not a type of strange thing. I mean, if for example the Prophet married daughter of Abu Sufyan, well, Uthman was a nobleman. He was one of those people who migrated to Medina among the first group. He was a close companion. We shouldn't think about things that happened later on afterwards. You judge Uthman as he was when he married daughters of the Prophet, not when what happened afterwards and those people later on. So I think we have to be more realistic about the issue. Okay, thank you very much.